Presently, I'm living in Dallas, Texas. Coming up in the plane yesterday, I brought a copy of the Saturday Evening Post with me. I noticed a little story about that law about a man from West Texas who some years ago built himself an electric automobile. And he drove to New York, and only cost him $1.89 for electricity and $6,924 for an extension cord. That sort of tickled me, you see. Exemplary of Texas. Of course, I am not a Texan by birth. I was born in Albany, New York. Went to school there. Started my drinking there. And I also, my family had a summer home in the town in Vermont, which is only 60 miles from Albany. And it was there that I first ran into Bill Wilson. He was born in a town, lived in a town about 6 miles north of the town where I summered. I guess the first time I ever met Bill was about 1911, which, of course, is a couple of years ago, even though I'm only 39, along with Jack Benny. Well, in 1912, Bill and I went to school together up there. I left the school I was going to, the private school in Albany. I went up there for a year, which, by the way, set me back a year when I went back to my original school because they didn't like it, my leaving. I got to know Bill pretty well. We became pretty good friends. And I saw him through the years afterward. And I took my first drink, I guess it was, in 1914. And Bill didn't start drinking until some years after that. I don't think he started drinking until after he came home from World War I. But we only got together on one drunk. And that was when he came to Albany one time and called me up. It was a Saturday. I happened to be in the office yet, Saturday morning. And he said, I'm in town, come on down and have a drink with me. And I said, that sounded good to me, so I went down and I had to show him all my spots in Albany and we took them in. And so happened I was playing around with a bunch of boys then who had a flying service in Albany. We got together with them that night. And somehow, out of that drinking party came the idea we'd fly up to Vermont the next day, which we did. And we arrived there, both of us, crocked, got out of the plane, and I think it was about the first or second plane that had landed in that little airport, and everybody was out there, and everybody knew Bill and I. But somehow, somebody got us into the hangar out of the way, so most of the townspeople didn't see us. And a guy sneaked the car up to the back end and we got out. But that's the only time that Bill and I ever drank together. I'm not going to go on any blow-by-blow description of drinking. My drinking soon got out of hand. And it went that way for a good many years. I'd sober up for a while on my own, under my own steam and get squared away for 4 or 5 months. I never could make 6 months. And then I'd go again. In 1934, I was living in our house in Vermont, all alone, and I was trying to paint the darn thing. And I had a ladder, and I couldn't get halfway up that ladder. I was drinking so hard, and I was shaking, and it was about this time when two fellows came to see me. And they, both of them, I had drunk with on many occasions. I don't think that they're strictly... They would strictly be classed as alcoholics, but they're heavy drinkers, and they didn't have trouble with it, but their main trouble, I think, was lust for power and business and things like that. And of course, that old stock market crash in 1929 knocked them out of the running. And they had become interested in an organization known as the Oxford Group. And they started talking to me about some very simple principles, which I had learned as a child, and asked me if I didn't think that Ebbie Thatcher was trying to run his life, and always had been, and why not try to give God a chance? Well, they left me with some pretty good ideas that I liked, And I got a hold of a boss painter who sent me a man and some equipment, and with the equipment, he and I sobered up for the time being. We painted the house. But as soon as that house painting was over, I went right back to the bottle. My interest is gone again. And as a consequence, in the course of 8 or 10 days, I got in trouble with the law. And I had been in trouble twice before that summer, and 3 times in Vermont, being 6 months in the state prison. But fortunately, one of the men who had come to see me was the son of the judge with whom I was taken before, and I was released under my own recognizance to another man who had been interested in the Oxford group, and he took me to New York. I stayed with one of these men, and then I moved into a mission in East 23rd Street, which was run by Calvary Episcopal Church, and it was run under Oxford group principles. I don't want to go into what the Oxford group was. It was a spiritual movement, and they certainly had a lot of good ideas, no question about it. They folded up, I think, because they were always trying to get the key people into the movement, and Christ himself was looking for the man on the street, the man who was a sinner. And I worked down there in that mission, that is, I lived there with 11 other men. They called ourselves the Brotherhood. And we had about 30 transients off the street every night. And in the daytime sometimes, I'd get downtown and go to Wall Street, knew some people down there. And I began to hear stories about Bill, that he wasn't entirely welcome down there anymore. He was drinking and gotten into trouble, and he was pretty well down. So I called him up one night, got his wife, and she asked me over for dinner. And that's a story you read in the big book. A little different, but only because I happen to be sober and remember it a little bit different. The principle of the thing is just about the same. And Bill walked home with me, and he walked to the subway with me, and he said, "I don't know what you got, but what it is, I want it." I think what he saw was the fact that I was sober for the first time in a good many years. I called him up from Albany at all times of the hour of the night, and here I was in New York, and under my own steam, and not drinking. So when I went to see Bill, I figured he'd either go for this thing whole hog or he'd have none of it. And the whole thing was that Bill was ready for it. And I just happened to be the guy, that's all, that went with it. Bill was ready for it at the time. And Bill and I worked together after he got his feet really on the ground. We worked together quite a while. And I stayed around New York for about 2 years, and then I went back to Albany, my hometown. I was only back there about 6 months, and I had trouble. And I've had trouble off and on over the years. I guess maybe if I wanted to figure the thing out, I could figure up 16 or 17 years. So I counted month by month, these sober months, but I couldn't string them out any length. But I've had a better record since I came to Texas. And since that's a bit of the story, how I got to Texas, it seems that a man in New York named Charlie Milton was in Paris, France, in the summer of 53, and they have a very small AA group there, and they did at that time. And he was there one night, and he met one of these original men who had come to see me in Vermont, one of the two guys from the Oxford group. And a guy said to him, "How's old Ebby doing?" And he says, "I don't know old Ebby, but I hear he's not doing very well." And I wasn't. Well, he says, "You know, I think he's licked in New York." He said, "Do you think there's any way you could ever get him out of there?" The guy said, "I don't know, but I'll try." And he came back to New York, and he did try. And I'm only citing this as an example of what I call AA in action, and not just talking about it. He called up the secretary of the intergroup, and he said, "If Ebby comes in, you tell him I want to see him." Well, this man had lived in Texas, and he married a Texas girl, lived in Dallas. And I came in there one afternoon, and she did the store, got on the phone, and he came right over from his office. And the first thing he said to me, "Where do you drink?" Well, I said, "There's a nice spot over here in Third Avenue. Let's go." So we went over there, and he bought me a couple of drinks, and we sat down. He said, "How'd you like to go to Texas?" Well, about that time, Texas was farthest from my thoughts, believe me. I had no idea going to Texas, but he began to tell me that he thought that I was licked in New York, and I knew it. I knew I was. I just couldn't throw that blanket of defeat off my shoulders. And he painted a pretty good picture of getting a new start on a new ground, although they say there's no such thing as a geographical cure. I, for one, will vote for it. Anyway, he gave me $5, and he said, "I'll meet you tomorrow night." He met me tomorrow night in the same process. He bought me a couple of drinks and left me with $5. He says, "Now, you're on your own. If you want to go, you call me up." That was Thursday night, and Saturday morning, I walked over in his apartment. He says, "You ready to go to Texas?" I said, "I don't know about Texas, but I'm ready to quit drinking. I quit drinking last night." And he said, "Come on up, we need to tune up." So he called up, one of the men he called up Ole Lancaster and Cersei Whaley right here. And I heard the guy said, "Well, send the Yankee son of a bitch down." And I heard it right over the phone. Excuse me for repeating the words he used. That was Ole Lancaster. So Sunday night, they loaded me on the plane. And I know that that thing, and they hardly rolled the doggone steps up to it, and I was out. I wanted out. I was nervous. Charlie never gave me a drink, and I heard afterwards he had a pint at the airport and never gave it to me. And I had quit drinking cold turkey, and there was Cersei and Ole to meet me. And I stayed at Cersei's clinic for a long time. And Cersei can tell you how sick boy I was. I never thought I was going to pull out of that mentally. I couldn't convince myself, and nobody else could convince me, that I was in Texas. I really had hallucinations and everything else. But they were patient, and they played with me, and finally it wore off, and I got back to normalcy again. I tell you, it was one time I was there, I know, but what was the name of that boy that was there at the clinic that time with you? From West Texas. Well, I can't. Anyway, he had to go out to the airport to mail some letters and get them out in airmail. And I said, "I want to ride out here." This is 2 weeks after I got there. And we got out there, and I got out of the car because he parked right in front of the old terminal. And there was a placard, a bronze placard on there. It said, "Love Field, Dallas, Texas." And I had to get out and put my hand on that thing and read it. And I said, "All right, I believe I'm in Texas." I should have. Didn't believe any of these drunks tell me that, you know. Well, anyway, things picked up for me, and I went along for about 13 months to never drink, and then I got off the wire again and started drinking. But fortunately, that didn't last so long. I drank off and on for about 10 days, and then I finally was pulled out of it. Unfortunately, I haven't had a drink since. That was in 1st of November, 1954. I met some people in Kansas City, two or three men there, asked me. They said there's a lot of things written about the new man and the help for the new man, but there's very little to help a man who's having trouble. And I said, "Well, I ought to be able to speak on that with authority because I have had trouble all the time. But I don't know what it is. When we get off, have trouble like that. We get off and we don't seem to be able to stop. And I sometimes wonder if the prime reason, the number one reason, isn't the fact that our pride is hurt. Here we are, we've established a big record in AA, and everybody's looking up to us, and we get drunk. And all that's gone for me." And then, of course, the second reason, and it's a pretty good one, is you say, "Well, now that I've started this one, I might as well make a good one out of it. You got a good one rolling." What makes this drink? I don't know. Except it's wrong thinking, of course. I know it was in my case. I know that in the beginning of this thing, I had a picture every time I thought of taking a drink of exactly what would happen. It was like opening a series of doors and walking through them. Each one a little worse, the picture that was presented. Because I might take a drink in a saloon uptown New York, and by the third day I'd be down in the Bowery. And it was always the same thing. I don't care whether it was New York or Albany or Vermont or where it was. The pattern was the same, always downhill. Thought you could get away with it, and it didn't work. I know now that I can't take a drink. I knew that then, but I didn't have any incentive. And somehow, when I came to Texas, I found some incentive, some purpose in life. Although I don't know exactly what it is, but it's just a purpose to keep sober and try to do a little bit to make up for all the years that I wasted. I'm not much of an orator, I never was. But I like to look on the thing and count some of the blessings I have. There are some things I would like, or some things I sometimes need that I don't have. But I have to remember the mistakes I made and the blessings I have now. I know that if the chances are, if Charlie Milton hadn't come to New York and gotten after me and really went to work and got me down here, and if Cersei and those boys down there hadn't been back of me, I never would have survived. I never would have had the chance again to get on my feet and to make these trips and to meet all you good people. And I'm grateful for that, and I think that's about all I can say. Thank you.
We're doubly fortunate to have another man who's been closely associated with Ebby. And also, we're fortunate that we're going to boom in the Middle West. Because once we get these Texans moving into Illinois and Iowa, well, we're going to go places. And this next man moved from Texas to Springfield, Illinois. So, Cersei, will you take over from here?
Thank you very much. I guess this is the last speaker here. If I talk too loud, well, we can cut it down a little, I guess. Thank you very kindly for those nice words, and I'm sure we will be booming up, but I understand it's already booming before I... That's the reason I came, because Cleve and... Now, I think Harry is not transplanted, but there's several transplanted Texans up here, and I know they got money, so that's the reason I came on up behind them. They paid it away for me. To get Ebby up here and a few more, well, we'll be all right. We'll have things under control. I'm deeply grateful to be here today and to share with you in this wonderful anniversary meeting of the Blandin Group. And to see many, many of you out there whom I have not met before, but I feel like I know you because we share in the same problem and the same responsibility, the NAA. And I'm deeply grateful that I can again be on the program with Ebby. And this morning it seemed that a little group that I met with over here, there was, as usual, on Easter and Sunday morning, a deep sense of gratitude with me that I am not forced with the situation of going out and looking for a drink on Sunday morning. And I always tried to prepare for that, but I never made it. I was always out of hooch on Sunday morning, regardless of how much I stored in, because I had some drinking relatives, too. And they usually knew where my liquor was hidden, and I was usually out by the time I went to bed, so I couldn't find my liquor on a Sunday morning. And some of you may know, and some of you may not know, what a bleak Sunday morning can be without any liquor and a terrible hangover, and try to find some in a cabinet or here and there, and most of us have had favorite hiding spots, such as the vinegar bottle and this and that and the other. But and I had a few of those too, but a lot of times I forget where the vinegar bottle was. And it's a terrible thing to wake up without a drink and the uncertainty of life and all the things that go with compulsive pathological drinking. I've certainly intended to introduce myself. I'm Searcy, an alcoholic. And with the help of God and the AA program and all such people like you all over the world, I have not found it necessary to drink since May 10, 1946, for which I am deeply grateful. My period of sobriety doesn't put me in any particular position in AA so far as that's concerned. I'm just another drunk, and I'm just sober today so far. And because I made a contract this morning that I would stay sober today and through this day, and doing it a day at a time makes it so easy that I don't think I'll have any problem, unless I should get too closely associated with Cleve or Harry or some of these other boys here, and, you know, that can get you pretty upset sometimes. But my problem and my case history, as Abby said, if we all went told you our case history down the line over the years, about the only difference might be that you did your drinking in Iowa or Illinois or Detroit or here and there, and I did mine in Texas in the Southwest or California or someplace else. But the main thing is, and the sad part about it is, or the good part, the way we look at it now, is that we all wound up in the same place. We all wound up in a condition that nothing could be done about, we thought. And until we found this beautiful program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we had no way out. We didn't know there was any way out, and really there was no way out. And without this program, I wouldn't be here today sober and sharing this wonderful meeting with you folks today. For that, I'm deeply grateful. You know, I noticed on the program, I'm talking about these transplanted Texans, noticed on the program that gave a little history there about me being in Texas and then being in Springfield, Illinois. Now, well, I'll have you know that both Illinois and Texas claim me. Illinois claims I'm from Texas, and Texas claims I'm from Illinois. So actually, I'm an alcoholic without a home, so far as Illinois is concerned. They hope I'll move over here someplace. In talking with some of you, and I understand that we have many of our civilian friends, let me call them, here today, doctors, ministers, or people who are here to gather some information for themselves, or for the people that they know who might need this program or who are in a position maybe to help someone find this way of life down the line. Let me say a few words to you as I was asked to about the problem of alcoholism. And for that, I'm deeply grateful to do, because we in AA feel that we need the help of every ethically organized fellowship or group in our cities all over the world. The answer to the entire problem of alcoholism is knowledge, as you know. And that's the way we found this thing, is because someone else had the knowledge that there was a program that would work and would help us stay sober. So I might say that back in 1945, I had contact with a former friend of mine who had gone into Alcoholics Anonymous and told me about this wonderful program. But at the time, I was drunk, and I didn't understand what he was talking about. He just said there's a group of we fellows in Dallas who get together and talk over our problems, and we're staying sober, believe it or not. Of course, I didn't believe it, but I told him if he would, he said, let me send you some of the literature and what we call the big book, and this is information that will help you if you will read it. It will show you how this thing works to a degree, but that won't do it. You need some help from people like myself and people who are just like you for fellowship in this thing, and that's the way it works. But I'd like to send you the big book, he told me. And I said, well, for God's sake, don't send it to my home. Send it to Amarillo, Texas, because I don't want my wife to know I have a drinking problem, you see. So he sent the big book and some of the literature, the old Washington pamphlet, many of you remember, several little pamphlets, and I gazed over them a little bit, but not too much. But I carried those things home and hid them, I thought, from my wife. As I said, because I didn't want her to know I had a drinking problem. But during this course of time, from August 1945 to May 1946, when I finally went into AA, she had read the big book. She had read much of the literature that I had brought home. And because of that, she never mentioned it. Thank God. I think if she had, I wouldn't have sought any help or any further help from AA. But because she had some knowledge of what was wrong with me, then, well, frankly, I was able to keep her. That's about it. If she hadn't known and understood that this was an illness and that that something could be done about it, then she would have left long before then. But finally, in 1946, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I had not thought about what he had told me in August 1945 until one day in the latter part of April 1946, when suddenly I realized that something had to be done. And I called my friend and went to Dallas to find out about AA. Thank God I have not had a drink since. So there's been a lot of misconceptions and lack of knowledge about the problem of alcoholism over a long, long period of time. As to what an alcoholic was and what they're like and why they drink and this and that and the other. Who is an alcoholic? What is an alcoholic? And why are they that way? And of course, we don't know all the answers by a long shot. The only one thing that I've found out over the years that will hold up, even if we knew what was wrong with us, we'd still have to take the same treatment. So that's our pride in AA. Back many, many years ago, we've had first one of us say, well, so-and-so was an alcoholic. A fellow told me yesterday a while back that old Sam Houston was from Texas, and he was an alcoholic, and his nickname or name down the line was the Big Drunk. And so he may have been. I'm not sure. I never knew Sam, although he's almost that old. But I've heard a lot of people say that way back there, Columbus was an alcoholic. He started off on a trip. He didn't know where he was going. He didn't know where he was when he got there. And a woman paid for the whole damn thing. So he may have been. I already said that Paul Revere was an alcoholic. He got on his horse and rode off in seven different directions at one time. So he may have been an alcoholic too. But I think the first thing, and this is long, long ago, there was a French scientist, a woman French scientist, who said, this is over 1,000 years ago, I see in this type of drinking such as these few people have who are compulsive pathological drinkers, I see in this kind of drinking an illness such as any other illness or malady. That's over 1,000 years ago. Down through the years, we've had millions of pamphlets, millions of articles written about the problem of drinking, the problem of alcoholism, the problem of social drinking, the problem of this and that and the other kind of drinking. But really and truly, and when we come down to the facts of the thing, there is only one kind of drinking that is an illness, and that is compulsive, pathological drinking. Now, we have many, many people who are Saturday night spree drinkers, and we have many, many who will pull a little ditty on Saturday night, but they'll get up the next morning. If you see one of them eating hotcakes, you know he's not an alcoholic. You won't see a real true alcoholic eating any hot or anything sweet the next day or for some time. And you'll see the situation drinker, the guy who gets mad at his wife and runs off, and of course that's part of his alibi system. But he'll get mad at his wife and he'll run off and get drunk and say, well, if you hadn't treated me that way, I wouldn't drink like that. If you'd leave me alone, I wouldn't drink like that. If you'd just give me my freedom, and when I'm drinking, don't say anything to me. And we have many, many situation drinkers that drink because of this and that and the other, but the true alcoholic is a person who cannot incorporate alcohol into their system and guarantee their behavior. And believe me, that's the kind of drunk I am. After one drink, I could not guarantee what I would do next. I could not guarantee that I could quit any time down the line. Now, the compulsive pathological drinker, after they have been sober 5 days and no alcohol in their system and it's all eliminated in that period of time, there is no physiological compulsion to drink until we've had the first one. That's the reason we do it a day at a time. That's the reason we say the first drink is all that matters. Because after we've taken the first drink, there's no way. There is no way that we can control our behavior. And remember that our behavior and our bottles are only a symptom of what's wrong with us. Only a symptom of our illness, not what is wrong with us. Our drinking and our behavior after drinking and the bottles and the alcohol is not what's wrong with us. That's only a symptom. We use it to control the things that we use it for pain. We're the only people in the world who use alcohol for what it really is. My first cousin to ether, alcohol is very close, an anesthetic. So we have deep psychological, moral, physical, and all of those other pains that go along with the reason that we need an anesthetic to control that situation. We're the only people who use alcohol for what it really is. So ethyl alcohol, I thought was a great old gal, and I married her back in 1926. And I couldn't divorce her, though, until 1946. And I had a heck of a time getting a divorce, I'll tell you that. It was terrible. I know that I could never have forgiven myself for the things I did while I was drinking and under the influence of alcohol had I not known beyond any question of a doubt that I have an illness, that I have this disease, alcoholism. I had to be a sick person to sacrifice the love of my wife, to sacrifice hundreds of jobs, to sacrifice the love of my family, to sacrifice the love of my church, to sacrifice all of the things that a normal person would want, that I wanted worse than anything in the world. I sacrificed all of those things for ethyl alcohol. For a clear substance, ethyl alcohol, that would give me the feeling for a few moments that I wanted, that would eliminate all of those fears and angers and all of those hates and things that I had over many, many years. But that one little clear substance, ethyl alcohol, gave me that relief that I wanted. So the things that I did, and we say in our program that we must have been a little crazy. It doesn't say in those exact words, but I know that I was. But we must have been a little off our rocker during some of our drinking periods to have done the things that we did. But remember this, and I remember every time I see a drunk person on the street or any place, now he may not be an alcoholic just because he's drunk and stumbling, but I look upon that person as either a very sick person now or a person who will be very sick down the line not too far if he keeps drinking or if he can't control his drink. We're not prohibitionists. We have nothing against anybody. We're not allied with any sect or denomination or anything else in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, these things that I'm saying now, that alcoholism is a disease, AA doesn't say, because AA is not in the educational business. And they couldn't say that until AA came along and proved that the alcoholic could be helped and was worth helping. Our scientists, all of our methods of rehabilitation could not be started, could not be proven until AA came along and gave us this program of recovery, 12 simple steps, written by the first 100 alcoholics in AA that have never been able to be improved upon in any way. As smart as a lot of us have been down the line, and we've had some dillies like myself, you know, who would look like there might be some way to improve this program. Any rehabilitation program should be able to, we should be able to improve upon it in some way. But mind you that this AA program was written by the first 100 alcoholics in AA. And nobody's been able to improve upon it. 12 simple steps. Steps that have given us life back again. On May 10th, 1946, I was reborn, a different person. A different person than I had ever been, than I had ever hoped to be. And the happiness and tranquility and all of the things in my life that have happened since then have been good. Ever since the day that I accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic and was unable to do anything about it by myself. And believe me, no alcoholic can do it alone. Not any of us can do it alone. We've never been able to do it alone. We shall never be able to do it alone. And remember that no true alcoholic can stay sober in the continuous association of non-alcoholics altogether. You know, we in AA are kind of like bananas. If we get away from the bunch, we're going to get peeled. So it's good for us to stay with our bunch if we don't. And we have nothing against you civilians. We want you. We need you. We need your help. We need your understanding, not your sympathy, but your understanding. And your knowledge of what's wrong with us and how we have recovered may help thousands upon thousands who need this program as badly as we did. So please, for the sake of those suffering out there, gain some knowledge. Make it a point to talk to some member of Alcoholics Anonymous or someone who has recovered and who is recovering on this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, down the line, there's been a lot of misconceptions, and people still bring alcoholism into the moral light. When we talk about that alcoholism is a disease, and our own director of health, public welfare, and our United States government said the other day, this problem of alcoholism is our number 3 health problem in the United States today. So, I believe that. Only I believe it's a greater problem than that, because each of we who are active alcoholics, unlike any other disease, affect the lives of 20 other people. There is no other disease in the world where the afflicted person, the diseased person, the ill person, affects so many lives as the alcoholic. We affect our bosses, we affect our family, we affect our neighbors. We affect the lives of people all around. The average of 20 for each alcoholic. So you can see how many people are affected by each person who is an alcoholic. So when you get one alcoholic well, then you help 20 other people along with him. And that's the reason that, my wife has improved greatly since I've been sober. But we wouldn't say to a tubercular, use your willpower and don't cough. It's the same thing as saying to an alcoholic, use your willpower and don't drink. That's not enough. We wouldn't say to a diabetic, don't have those convulsions, don't eat the sugar, but there's a craving for it. And something has to be put in there to take the place of the sugar, the insulin, and those things. And your tubercular is helped by rest. And the same thing with alcoholics. If we take our treatment in AA and we come along and follow this program of recovery and do what it says, and it's so simple, a day at a time, we can't help but recover. Sure, we have some relapses. Not everybody who comes into AA who is an alcoholic stays sober. But our recovery ratio is higher than any other method in the world known for treating alcoholics. If there's a recovery program known for any illness, and here is a method of treatment that 25% are helped or recover, here's another program that 3% recover. Here's another program that there is 15% recovery. But here's another program where there's 75% recovery, overall recovery. Well, which program am I going to take? I'm going to get in the 75% bracket because I've got a better chance. So that's the same thing in AA. But everyone and all of us who come into this program and do what we are told to do and follow this program to the best of our ability, not like John or Jim or Mary does it or anybody else, but the way we understand it ourselves and apply this program to our lives daily, we can't help but stay sober. But remember this, you who are non-alcoholics and here today in the interest of us, and we appreciate it. Remember this, unless the alcoholic is accepted back into his community for what he is, we don't want to be accepted for anything we're not. But just as a recovering alcoholic, back into our civic club, back into our society, back into our churches, back into this and that and the other, we just want to be accepted for what we are. And if you will accept us just for what we are, then we'll come along and be socially prominent in your midst. I assure you of that. The alcoholic is not a bad person. We actually, our criminal rate with true alcoholics is very, very low. We have some borderline cases, yes. We have some with other tendencies and other complications, but not the true alcoholic. The true alcoholic, our criminal rate among them is very, very low. Very low. So here's a problem that has been controversial over a long period of time. And on the other side, here is a recovery program that has proven itself over a period of 25 years. These three things, and the program of AA doesn't say this, but it has proven these things. Just accept it for what we are. I want to just take a second regarding the AA program. You know, spirituality is something that all of we alcoholics were looking for over, as Eddie told you. That's what Bill was looking for. That's what Dr. Bob was looking for. Eddie had it and was able to pass this thing along. How great is the power of spirituality. And to me, spirituality is the reflection of godliness in the channels of human living. Let me repeat that because it's the way I can understand it. No other way. Spirituality is the reflection of godliness into channels of human living. And I can understand it that way. I can understand spirituality in the AA program. I don't know much about it on the religious side or down the other way. But I can understand that I want to be the kind of person that might reflect a little godliness into the lives of other human beings. And that's our purpose in AA. In the last step of the AA program, there is a paragraph which says, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So I got to thinking, what are the principles of AA? What are the principles of the 12 steps? And let me hurriedly go over these, my conceptions of the principles of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you who have not known the AA program or know what it's about, to me, this is my conception of what the principles of AA are. And I believe that you'll agree with me that these principles and everything about the AA program is fine. There's nothing about the AA program that anybody can say anything but that it's good. So if you'll bear with me on these principles, these are my ideas of what they might be. In the first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Now, this is a principle of absolute honesty. Absolute honesty. And we must do this. We must admit that our lives are unmanageable, that we're powerless over alcohol, that we alone cannot do anything about it. So absolute honesty is a good principle, isn't it? And that's what we need. Our second step is we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now, this is a principle of faith. Faith in this power greater than we are. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We have to have the faith of a child. We have to have that blind faith, a faith that we have not known before, but a trust, a faith. And that takes courage for an alcoholic, for someone who has not known what real faith was in the past. Our step number three is we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. Now, this is a principle of action. We found out we had to do something about what was wrong with us. We found out that we had to make a decision of some kind, a good decision, a decision that would hold water, a decision that would help us to understand this power greater than ourselves better. But this is a principle of action, and it's something we needed to take. Step number four, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Now, this is a principle of courage. C-O-U-R, the word comes from, means from the heart. So that's what we had to do. We had to have the courage to make a searching and fearless moral inventory. And if you had been lucky enough to do that, to take this step, you've been lucky enough to stay sober. When we make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, whether you're alcoholic or not, that's a mighty good way to live. Make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, and that takes courage when you've done some of the things I've done in the past. Step number five, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrong. The exact nature of our wrong. Now, this is a principle of integrity. And some of our great statesmen, not too far back, who have gone into many, many foreign countries and visited those countries. I talked with one who had visited some 22 foreign countries. And he said, you know what those people want to know over there? They don't care how many Cadillacs we have or how long they are. They don't care what our homes are like or how they're dressed up. They don't care what kind of clothes we wear. They don't care about anything except one thing. When will the United States take the spiritual leadership of the world. And I believe in our AA program we have spiritual leadership like we've never seen before. I think it's the greatest spiritual program that we've ever seen or ever will see. But those people don't want to know about anything else, and isn't that great to know that we have such a program here? When will your country take the spiritual leadership of the world? And that, I think that's great. Our next step, number 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. That's the step of willingness. Willingness to be made whole. And I think that is a great thing in the AA program. Just a willingness to be made whole. And we have to come to that point, we who are sick and come into AA, become willing to do wholesome things. Be willing to do things for other people and not be found out. Our step number 7, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. This is a principle of humility. Our step number 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. This is loving kindness, a principle of loving kindness. Our step number 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Now, I think that's self-discipline. I think that's disciplining ourselves to do the things that we know we should by making direct amends to people we have hurt and people we have injured over the years. Our step number 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Now, this is a principle of steadfastness, which is almost covered exactly in the previous step. Our step number 11, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And that's our step number 11, which is a step, a principle of unity. And without unity, we have nothing in AA. It's wonderful to see these wonderful groups here unitizing themselves together to put on a program where we can come together and share all of the things, the beautiful things in this great program. Our step number 12 is, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics, and here is the part that I've been talking about, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. As we know, the 12th step of the AA program is a principle of service. And we know that so long, if we want to keep our sobriety, if we want to keep our peace of mind, if we want the happiness and tranquility that we seek in this program, we can't keep it. We've got to give it away. We've got to give it to somebody else we don't have it. And that's the reason we're anonymous. The spiritual foundation of this program is anonymity. It doesn't matter who I am, what my full name is, at all. And the only thing that we have left when we leave this program or leave this earth and we're sober are the things we have given away in AA. And that's true in life as a whole, isn't it? The only thing we have left is what we've given away. But if we don't have anything to give away, then we can't help anybody to help ourselves. So it behooves me to try to know all I can about this wonderful program, how I can help somebody else and not be found out about it. How I can apply this program to myself so that the person I'm talking to, although it's difficult for an older person to talk to a man who's still having trouble, yes. You can say, I've been there, old boy. I know what you're going through with. But it's difficult for that person to understand that you do know what he's talking about and the condition he's in. If you've been sober a while and you've got on a clean shirt and you're looking pretty good, it's pretty hard to make that old boy believe. But we have to get out with that man and that woman and make them know that we understand their problem. So will you who are non-alcoholics here today, if there be any doctors or ministers, people from all walks of life who may be here, share with us the knowledge of this great, great program. You're interested in our heart disease, you're interested in our muscular dystrophy, you're interested in our cancer problem, you're interested in all those other things. Believe me, if you want to have some happiness, gain some knowledge of this non-controversial illness and disease of alcoholism. And when you help an alcoholic, believe me, they are forever grateful for that help. So in the AA program, we have the principles in our steps are absolute honesty, faith, action, courage, integrity, willingness to be made whole, humility, loving kindness, self-discipline, steadfastness, unity, and service. To me, that is the principle of the AA program. It's been great to be with you good people, and I know I've taken a lot of time. Good to be with Abby, and I'm so grateful to all of you for this privilege of coming here and breaking bread with you. Well, I think there's great wisdom in the old line that said, keep down my feet. I do not ask to see the distance seen. One step is enough for me. Thank you very much.